If you are a follower of Jesus and you have children, your children are your legacy. The greatest thing you will ever do in life, the greatest accomplishment will be to raise your kids to follow the way of Jesus. It's not a secondary thing. It's not a side thing. It's the most important thing. When you get old and you look back, that's what you will really consider your success or failure, is what God did through your children. And so just remember that. That's why the Apostle John said in 3 John 4, I have no greater joy than this, to hear of my children walking in the truth.
Hey, podcast family, and welcome to episode number 284 of the L3 Leadership Podcast, where we are obsessed with helping you grow to your maximum potential and to maximize the impact of your leadership. My name is Doug Smith, and I am your host, and today's episode is brought to you by my friends at Bear Tongue Advisors. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. I'm so glad that you're here, and I hope that you'll enjoy our content and become a subscriber. And if you've been listening to us for a while, thank you so much, and just make sure that you've subscribed on whatever app you listen to podcasts through. And also, if you would leave us a rating and review, that would mean the world to me. That helps us grow our audience and reach more leaders, which is our whole focus here at L3 Leadership. So thank you in advance for that. Well, in today's episode, you'll hear my conversation with Phil and Diane Comer. And Phil and Diane are actually the parents of John Mark Comer. And if you're unfamiliar with John Mark wrote a book called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, which made a significant impact on my life in 2020. And I've been recommending it to everyone that I know ever since. And I started following John Mark after I read his book. And a few months later, my wife bought me a book for my birthday. And the book was called Raising Passionate Jesus Followers. And she said, this book is by John Mark Comer's parents, Phil and Diane Comer. And I said, well, I can't wait to get into it. And as I started reading about them, they raised 4 kids, including John Mark, who are all living for God and making a difference in the world. And Laura and I read the book so quickly because it was unbelievable. It was the most practical book on parenting that we've ever read. And we've been gifting it to parents all the time because literally we believe every parent needs to read this book. And Phil and Diane are the real deal. They've been married for 41 years. I already mentioned that they've raised 4 kids who are changing the world, living for God. And they've been in ministry together that entire time. And they have a crazy life story. You're going to love this interview. And if you're a parent, you're really going to love it. And again, please get a copy of this book. There'll be a link in the show notes, Raising Passionate Jesus Followers. Again, one of the best parenting books I've ever read, the most practical for sure. But before we get into the interview, just a few announcements. This episode of the L3 Leadership Podcast is sponsored by Bear Tongue Advisors. The financial advisors at Bear Tongue Advisors help educate and empower clients to make informed financial decisions. You can find out how Bear Tongue Advisors can help you develop a customized financial plan for your financial future by visiting their website at beartongueadvisors.com. That's BERATUNG advisors.com. Securities and investment products and services offered through Waddell & Reed, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC. Bear Tongue Advisors, Waddell & Reed, and L3 Leadership are separate entities. I also want to thank our sponsor, Henny Jewelers. They're a jeweler owned by my friend and mentor, John Henny. And my wife and I got our engagement and wedding rings at Henny Jewelers, and we just loved our experience. Not only do they have great jewelry, but they also invest in people. In fact, every engaged couple that comes into their store, they give a book to help them prepare for marriage. And we just love that. So if you're in need of a good jeweler, check out hennyjewelers.com. And with all that being said, let's dive right into the episode. Here's my conversation with Phil and Diane Comer. Hey, Phil and Diane, thank you so much for taking the time to do this interview. And why don't we just start off with you both just telling us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Wow. Well, we're Phil and Diane Comer, and we've been married almost 43 years. Mm-hmm. And we met each other in the Bay Area in California. I grew up in what I call a God-fearing home, but I had no clue who Jesus was. And I gave my life to the Lord in college, and he radically changed my life. And I left this band I played in for 9 years and ended up becoming a worship pastor as a young guy. And Diane was singing, back then it was choir. She was singing in the 100 Voice High School choir. And you couldn't date, if you're on staff, you cannot date girls in the high school group. So the week after she graduated, I asked her out.
And I said, yes.
That's
we
awesome.
Got married, and then we dated for a while, got married. And we just love the Lord. We love ministry. And I think we'll get into our story here about raising passionate Jesus followers. But that's where we met and fell in love, and I've been serving the Lord. We have this oneness of spirit where we both feel a call to vocational ministry. I mean, all believers are in the ministry. We all are, but we've had a lot of wonderful experiences and together.
Yeah. And my story is similar. I grew up never hearing about Jesus. Our family went to church occasionally, like they believed in God, but didn't know what to do with that. And ended up being in Europe for many years and came home as a teenager and heard the gospel for the first time because of a group from a church just kind of swept me into their social circle. And I found out who Jesus was for the first time, and I've been following him really ever since. And we, like Phil said, we both love church ministry and have done that our whole lives. And now we have this passion for basically for parents like we were all those years ago. Our oldest just turned 41 yesterday. And all those years ago, we were Phil and Diane who had no idea what to do. We looked at Christian families and thought it just seems like they know what they're supposed to be doing, and read every book we could find, a sliver of a chapter to say, "What? How do you do this?" And now we're in awe to see all four of our children and their spouses, and now our grandchildren beginning also to follow Jesus. And it's just, it really is true. There's no greater joy than seeing our children walking with the Lord.
Yeah. You know, we both got saved in what's called the Jesus Movement, which was probably the last great revival in America. And so we were part of this church that grew to be one of the first mega churches in California in the Jesus Movement days. And this youth group grew from 14 to 1,000. So you had all these passionate kids, but so many of them, their parents weren't walking with the Lord. And so we really came to know Jesus. He changed our life. But then when it came to having our firstborn, our youngest is 29. We got two girls in between. In our book, we write about, you know, what, how do we do this? No, because we had no model. So we had to look to others in the church who became our mentors.
I'm certainly glad you were intentional about seeking that out, because you just wrote a new book. And actually, I found you through the fruit of your parenting skills. So about a year and a half ago, a friend handed me a book called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry that was written by your son, John Mark. And that transformed my life. And so I've been following him and his work for the past year and a half. And I was telling you, you know, before we jumped on the interview earlier this year, I was telling someone about The Ruthless Elimination, and someone recommended your book to my wife, and we got a copy and we could not put it down. We are in a season, we have three little ones at home. And so we're trying to gather, like you did, as many resources as we can to make sure that we are great parents and raise world-changing kids who are passionate for Jesus. And this book was just the roadmap that we needed. I've been buying copies. My wife and I have been buying copies for our friends. Anyone we know with little ones, it's like, you have to read this book. And so I want to spend the majority of our time together just going through the book. And I am curious, you know, you gave a little bit about your story, but why did you write this book and what do you hope the parents get from it?
We wrote the book that we wish we'd had when John Mark was first born.
Yeah.
And in fact, all throughout the book, every chapter, which is grouped according to age and formation, Phil would ask me, Di, what did you, two questions. What were they?
What do you wish we knew, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
what do you wish we'd done,
what do you wish we'd done differently? So we basically wrote what we wished we'd been able to grab hold of at that point. We were asked to do this by the elders of our church. It's a long story how it came about, but it was really something God just called us to, and we did it. John Mark really was the catalyst.
And to be clear, we didn't know everything that we wrote about when we were raising our children. So we tried to make sure that we included as much of that as we could so that, you know, really, obviously, you can learn in many ways from our teaching, but even maybe more from our willingness to say, hey, we blew it here and it caused us some problems. And here's how we could have avoided that. If we just understood these scriptures, if we'd understood this wisdom, we would have done this differently. And hopefully that will help parents just as much as the teaching parts of it.
I'm so glad that you found this book with your young children, because really it's a book that I would call on the preventative side. In other words, this is what God has for you, and this is what you could see happen if you begin as early as possible and follow the way of the Lord, as opposed to a book like, what do I do now? My 18-year-old has no interest in church. My 20-year-old smoking pot. You know, like, if that's your story, you need help. And there's people that really are experts really at helping people out of brokenness. But ours is like, we're amazed that so many young families like you. So when you're our age, it's like your dream that young families are actually even listening to you, right?
As they're just beginning. Yeah. Yes, we've
got people coming who are just pregnant or just had their first baby. And so we're really excited to see God using it in people's lives. But especially it's mostly young parents that are following our book and our ministry.
Yeah, I mean, I already can see, I believe this is a divine appointment in so many young people's lives and parents' lives. So thanks again for being willing to write it. And I love that you break the book down into sections based on seasons of parenting. But before you get into that, you basically set the vision for raising a godly family. And you made a few statements that I would love to just talk about. You made the statement in the book that Christian parents do not automatically spawn Christian kids. Mm-hmm. Can you just speak to that? I thought that was a good statement.
First of all, parenting is not an exact science. And every child has a free will to choose to follow the Lord or not. And so that's what we mean by that. And I got to serve with an evangelist who is a dear friend named Luis Palau. He just went to be with the Lord. And I heard him stand in stadiums and say, God has no grandchildren, only children. In other words, you don't get to be with the Lord forever because your dad was a pastor, because your mom was so godly, or your grandma was the saint. You know, each generation must make their own decision. And so we're just saying it's not automatic if you take your kids to church and they're just going to grow up and follow the Lord. That said, if children are raised in a home where Jesus is truly at the center and mom and dad are personally walking with him and he's the center of their marriage and there's that love and security that mom and dad are never going to leave each other and there's so much love in the home and Christ is at the center, I mean, why would you not want that? So I think that's what the Bible means when it says train up a child in the way he should go and when he is old, he will not depart from it, Proverbs 22:6. So there's no guarantee, but it's quite likely that they're going to choose to follow the way of the Lord, if their parents have been the real thing, they've lived authentically. They're not one thing on Sunday, another thing on, you know, during the week or whatever.
But it was also because we heard Christian parents say, well, we tried to be a good example to our kids. And it began to dawn on us just by reading the scriptures. And by the way, Paul fathered Timothy specifically, mm-hmm. that not only do we need to be a good example to them and be the real deal, but we actually have to intentionally teach them the ways of Jesus everydays of our lives. This is the way the world or their own desire would do things, but this is the way of Jesus. Yeah. And as you were constantly actually teaching the way of Jesus mm-hmm. to our children, it becomes the normative for them so that someday when they have to choose and you're not there to make them choose, they'll be able to put the two side by side and make a wise choice. So part of that is just because your kids are in your home and you're walking with Jesus and you really are living into the gospel doesn't mean that they'll follow him. We also have to teach and train them.
Yeah.
And part of having a vision, you share a lot about generations in the front end of the book and having a vision for a generation beyond just your kids or grandkids. You actually lay a vision for, I believe you said biblically, that a generation is defined by 300 years. Can you talk a little bit about having a vision beyond just your kids?
Well, a generation is actually about 25 years. So what we did is trace like 12 generations, I think it was.
Because, 100, yeah.
Yeah, get to 300 years. Because when we were first starting out, and John Mark was just about 6 months old, and Phil was in grad school, I'd picked up this book at a used Christian bookstore that was a biography of Jonathan Edwards. It had been written in the 60s and comparing two families, there was a social study done of the Edwards family and their amazing, incredible, far-reaching impact on our nation and this other family of criminals and their amazing cost to our nation. And as I'm reading the book and reading it out loud to Phil at night. With this weird title, the title of the book.
Marriage to a Difficult Man. She'd read it in bed at night next to me, right?
That's beautiful.
It really was the story of Jonathan and Sarah Edwards through the lens of their children and his wife and how he led his family. And he was a complex man who we would now say probably suffered from some pretty severe bouts of depression. But seeing the impact of his family on our nation just elicited in us a vision for could God use us in our own unique way to impact our world. We're First generation Christians, our parents did, we were thankful for, later come to know and love Jesus. But we were the first generation, and we began to pray for generations after generations of Comers who would follow hard after Jesus. And that has become really the guiding, I would say, passion of our lives over everything. We just felt so strongly. At the time also, Christian radio was a big thing before we had podcasts. And I was listening pretty much daily to different teachers. And I kept hearing this same thread run throughout their stories. It was like back in the day, it was Chuck Swindoll and some of those famous
mega pastors. I call them mega pastors.
Yeah. And thinking, gosh, how did they even know all this stuff, you know? And as still first generation Christians. And I kept hearing the same thing repeated in their story. Most of them came from multiple generations of passionate Jesus following parents and grandparents and great grandparents. So that showed us that we were just starting this, and that it would be really through our children that we would have by far the greatest impact on the kingdom. And on the one hand, humbling that we had limitations starting so late. On the other hand, it informed everything we did from then on, not being child-centered parents, but being very intentional about bringing our children along to follow Jesus as we were learning to follow him.
Yeah. So really, we figured out, we believed that the greatest thing we would ever do for the kingdom would be what we saw God do through our children. Mm-hmm. And of course, John Mark is probably the most publicly known of our four kids, but God is using all four of our kids mm-hmm. to accomplish far more than we will probably, we'll be with the Lord unless he comes back, you know, sooner. There'll be what God will be doing through them and then through their children while we're mm-hmm. with the Lord, it will go on for generations. And that's what I want young parents to understand. When you get up in the morning, you're exhausted and your three-year-old throwing a tantrum and you got to change a messy diaper and, you know, whatever. It's not just what you do that day. When you raise those kids to walk with the Lord and you fast forward 20 years and they start getting married and they raise their kids to walk with the Lord and their kids walk with the Lord, what you're doing tomorrow morning is affecting generations to come. And when you do the math, it turns into one family. If you raise your kids to follow the Lord and they raise their kids to follow the Lord and they raise their kids, what Diane did is carried it out 12 generations, and it's 16 million something Jesus followers from one family. Now, of course, not all will choose to follow, but you can see it's going to be in the millions. So it just gives parents so much hope. Like, what I'm doing is of eternal significance because God ordained the family. It's the basic unit of society. And when families are strong, nations are strong. And you see in America, as the family crumbles and falls apart, our nation is crumbling and falling apart. But we can be the light. We can be, we can bring strength. We can bring grace. We can bring the kingdom of God everywhere we go. And it's affecting generations to come.
And we can bring others into our family. Yeah. And this is really important and really crucial, is that we aren't just a, you know, us four no more, you know, kind of a family unit. We are part of the body of Christ. And just like families opened their home to me as a 15-year-old, just hearing the gospel for the first time, not knowing how it should or would affect my life, he brought me mothers and fathers mm-hmm. who kind of brought me under their wing while my parents were figuring it all out. And they discipled me. They took me on as their project. They corrected me at times, things that I was oblivious to. That's an important element of this too, because every parent, you know, we're blessed according to the scriptures. Abraham was blessed so that he would be a blessing. Mm-hmm. And we as parents are blessed in order to be a blessing. So at the same time, we're looking around who is it has a natural affinity in our family that just we have this connection with, and we bring them along with our kids, hoping that we're going to influence a whole nother generation of people.
Which, of course, is what Jesus was talking about when we read in the Gospels. He's teaching, the room is packed, and his mother and brothers show up, and they go, your mother's outside. He goes, who are my mother and sister and brothers? Those who do the will of God. People take that a little too far and kind of slam the nuclear family. That's not what he was talking about. Yeah. I guarantee you, he went outside afterwards and said, hi, mom, how are you? Because when he was dying on the cross, the last thing he did was take care of his mom. But what he was saying was the kingdom of God is bigger than just your family. So yeah. When we bring others into the family, it's a beautiful thing. And so many people do not have even a mother and a father who stay together and their hearts are broken. And so they can come to a family like yours and experience the love of Christ in something they've never experienced or known. And then they're going to say, I want that. Mm-hmm. And then they can choose to follow the Lord. Even if their parents split up or their parents didn't follow the Lord, they can start fresh like we did. Mm-hmm. And then later on, our parents began to follow Jesus because they were on our prayer list for a long time.
Wow, that's huge. And so, Diane, very similar to you, my in-laws, actually, I was a troubled kid, lost my mom in high school. Through that, long story short, someone invited me to a Bible study that was led by my wife's mom. And I was a drug dealer in my high school. And I left Bible study that first night. And my wife told her mom, I can't believe Doug came to Bible study. If he ever, he's the most influential kid in our high school. If he ever got a hold of God, he could change the world. And I went home that night and told my buddies that I met the girl I'm going to marry, talking about my wife. So I did call my shot. But, but for whatever reason, God, you know, tapped my mother-in-law on the shoulder and they started bringing me over for family dinners and showed me an entirely different model of family than I'd ever been a part of. And really my father-in-law and mother-in-law raised me. I would say still to this day, I'm 36, but that's huge. And so parents, if you're listening to this, look for others that you can bring into your family as well. It sounds like it changed Diane's life. I know it certainly changed mine. So thank you for sharing that.
Doug, you just don't look like a drug dealer. You look so handsome.
I can send you some photos. Anyway.
Glory of Jesus, how he changed his life. You know, and there's so many stories like yours. A couple that's on our board, he's executive pastor at our church. Same thing. You know, he's Canadian and married an American, and he grew up and his parents were just caught up in their careers. He was like a latchkey kid. And then he started dating this girl, and just all he wanted to do was be at their house because that's where he learned what a family looked like that followed Jesus, and he ended up marrying her. You know, same story as yours.
And there was
later on his
dads we know.
He's one of the best fathers we know, and now his parents later are following the Lord. But you know, great story. I'm glad you shared it.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing on the vision side is really you have to make this a central focus. If you're going to raise passionate Jesus followers, it has to be, you actually made a statement that I loved. You said, we made our kids our life calling, putting them before ministry, careers, personal comfort, and our own agendas. And so leaders, if you're listening to this, parents, please make this a focus. It has to be your number one priority if you're going to achieve that. I want to move now into more of the different seasons of parenting. And you start with the season that I'm in. You called it the foundation, and it's birth through five, which is where all three of my kids fall. Can you just talk a little bit about this stage? And then, you know, we can dive into some of the specifics you shared in the book.
Yeah, I mean, laying, you know, we all know what a foundation is. You think of building a house, the foundation is critical, right? If the foundation isn't solid, the whole house is going to lean or creek or eventually fall down, especially in California where the earthquakes are. And we believe that parenting, these first 5 years are critical. You know, you have to be all in. I mean, Diane always encourages the young moms who are exhausted. She goes, the problem with parenting, is it so?
Daily.
You know, talk about the foundation, babe. And I mean, you start off, you know, nursing these childs, and what did you do?
And carrying the child, even in pregnancy. Now science is telling us that even the pregnancy matters as far as a child who is not anxious or prone towards even illness. So, I mean, in those first few months where you're just caring for a person who is completely dependent on you, literally you're keeping them alive. And it's exhausting and it's more intense than anybody is prepared for. I've talked to and met with so many career women who are really at the top of their careers and they have their first baby and think they're going to be in and out of there in 12 weeks, you know, maternity leave at the most. And they're just absolutely discombobulated by the whole thing, by the absolute constant need. It's completely different skill set. And no mom ever feels like she's got it. And no dad ever feels like he can be enough help in the process. But those are critical years of teaching your child what it means to turn to God for comfort. So you think you're just comforting a distraught child, an angry child, a sick child. In reality, you are getting them comfortable for the Father's arms so that someday they know to run to him for comfort and for care rather than run to a bunch of different people or a bunch of different things or substances that bring the comfort that all of us are actually made and wired up to desperately need. So what your wife and you are doing right now with those kids, and they fall down and hurt themselves, or they get so mad at each other or whatever. It's critical right now because you're building something into their DNA, into their very bone structure that will inform their walk with God in future years.
Yeah, so. You're showing them who God is. I like to say to fathers, father like the father. Yeah. Look at how the father fathers you. You know, and I just a little story here just came to my mind when John Mark was our firstborn. Of course, your firstborn, you definitely don't know what you're doing. But he was super, he's super driven, super hard to unwind. And, you know, we were probably doing everything wrong. But I remember he was probably 14 months old. He's over a year old. And I was still having to sing him to sleep. You know, he'd be on my, you know, I'd be holding him, walking back and forth and back and forth singing, you know, and I'd sing Amazing Grace, How Great Thou. I'm singing Jesus songs to him. And I'd finally get him asleep. And then, you know, the trick is to get him off your shoulder and into bed without waking up. And I remember this so vividly. As soon as I tried to move him off, he'd wake up and grab hold of my neck and say, sing more, Daddy. So he'd literally cling to me. And then I was reading Deuteronomy one day where it actually says, serve the Lord and cling to him. So when you are an earthly father giving your kids that comfort, that fatherly daily presence and comfort, you're teaching them one day how to go to the Father and cling to him. So anyway, these first 5 years, a lot of parents, you know, kids are so cute. And so they went, but they very quickly after, you know, 1 year old or, you know, they have a strong will and you don't touch that and they touch it to what you're going to do about it. So, you know, we like to say by age five, and you want to see in your son or daughter a heart of obedience, not perfectly, but they need to be able to accept no. And if and a lot of parents that are too loose in the first 5 years and all of a sudden they've got an 8 year old kind of defying them and they, where did that come from? It's because they didn't do the hard work in birth through five. So if laying the foundation is so important, if you do, if you're on it during those first 5 years mm-hmm. and you do the hard work, and even though you're physically tired, you're going to have way more fun later yes. on. And so we like to call it the foundation that you're beginning to see self-control in their life. You're beginning to see them to have a heart of obedience. And mm-hmm. maybe you want to say more about that, babe, but it's probably the most important season yes. of parenting is those first 5 years.
Yes.
Wow. And Jesus gave the analogy when he talked about, you know, building your house on sand or on the foundation. He said, and everyone who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a house that was planted on solid rock. And mm-hmm. so that's what you want to do with your kids. And so singing songs about him, Diane would tell him that story about when you were exhausted and you were nursing and you couldn't, your kids wouldn't sleep at night. And
I was complaining out loud to a friend. I was just exhausted. I think this was with our fourth. So I also had middle schoolers and carpools. And I complained out loud to a friend in passing. And she said, Diane, you need to take those hours in the night to pray through his life.
Wow.
And to intercede. She was explaining to me what intercession was. And so I did. I mean, what a great challenge. Actually, I think that was with my firstborn, because I remember thinking he's never going to sleep through the night because I need to keep praying for this boy through all the next stages of his life. But even in those very early years is where you lay a foundation for discipline, which is, we came to discover in the scriptures, is not punishment. Punishment is a sort of a pushing away. It's you get what you deserve, shame on you, consequence, consequence, consequence. And some of that obviously has to happen in their lives. But biblical discipline is training and leaves one with a sense of security. I mean, Hebrews 12 explains to us what we all know, that no discipline in the moment
seems joyful.
I was just reading Hebrews 12 the other day and realizing that some of the unease in my life is because I had unconfessed sin in my life, that I, as I was honest with God, that I'd been speaking about a situation too negatively and critically, and I needed to confess that sin. Of course, as soon as I did, and then went in and told Phil, I just had just absolutely that sense of peace. I messed up. I knew better. I knew I'd been being warned by the Spirit, but that instant relief of instant forgiveness and freedom, I don't have to get all caught up in being critical about a situation. I can really trust the Father with it. That's the discipline that we do with our children. So we had so much fun studying the four tools of discipline and realizing more than anything else is it's almost all communication. It's almost all talking. And maybe that's why parenting is so exhausting. Honestly, it's easier to throw consequences at our kids and go tell them to go to their room than it is to sit down and say, okay, you did it this way. You could have done it that way instead. And you know, that's the way God disciplines us. He says, Diane, you were trying to carry this load and you were turning more and more critical of the situation and judgmental of the situation. Instead, you could have let me handle it and trusted it with me and believe that I have it. That's how he trains us, and that's how we train our children.
Can I read a couple of verses out of Hebrews? I won't read the whole passage, but it says, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them. And you know, that's it. Parenting is not an exact science. Sometimes we go, you know, I didn't handle that well. I was too harsh or I was too lenient or whatever. But God knows that. Yeah. He said, we're doing it as seemed best to us. But then it goes on to say, but he, God, disciplines us for our good. Here's why, that we may share in his holiness. Well, we might become godly. All discipline for the moment seemed not to be joyful. That's what Diane quoted, but sorrowful. Yet to those who have been trained by it, and there's this patient instruction, afterwards it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So you will see fruit in your son and daughter's life when you patiently instruct them in the way of the Lord. And they might not like it at certain times, but but it's a beautiful thing. And Diane likes to say we parent out of relationship. And I like to remind moms and dads that you have the more influence in the life of your sons and daughters than anybody ever will. Mm-hmm. God's given them to you. They belong to him, but he's given them to you for a time, and no one will ever have as much influence in their life as you do. And so that you need to steward that well and do it as seems best to you and ask God for wisdom. But as you do these things, you'll see amazing fruit in the lives of your kids.
Uh-huh. Yeah. When it came to correction, what I loved about the book is there's so many practical things that parents can just implement immediately. And, you know, a few that stood out that I would just love to hear you talk about. This was actually life-changing for Laura and I. No timeouts. We had started to do the timeout thing, and then we read your book, and we don't do timeouts anymore. But can you talk about that specifically? I just thought that was so interesting.
Well, instead of timeouts, we called them time-ins. Because what we believed is we began to understand that discipline and punishment are two different things, and that God disciplines and doesn't punish us, that we saw that our children's response to timeouts or being sent to their room was a rejected response. But we also were watching kids raised in Christian homes and seeing a pattern. We would see them reach teenage years and perhaps make a really shameful decision that they knew better, but they're teenagers and they exercised their will and they made a choice. So many of those kids, instead of coming to a point of conviction and running back to the Father for comfort, for cleansing, for hope and renewal, were running away from God because they were so filled with shame. So we wanted to not add any shame to our kids, basically. So that's why we stopped the timeout and did time-ins, which was because there are sometimes your child is just getting more and more wound up and all sorts of sensory stimulation and competition and
too much screen time,
too much sugar, too many late nights, you know, you name it. And they start to kind of implode. So we had at our house this big green, kind of emerald green corduroy chair that sat by the window. Let them eat snacks in there.
But it was worth it.
And we would have a time in. And, you know, it was a time of comforting them, realizing they have to at some point learn how to settle themselves down, to self-soothe, to get to a point in their lives when they've lost their temper as an adult and they know how to come back down from that and without destroying people around them. And so we'd get their favorite blankie.
Book.
Tea. I, you know, grew up in Europe. So in a British school system, tea, you know, solves every problem. So I'd make him a cup of tea. read a story. Reading a story is amazing for a time in because it just unlocks their brain that is locked into how they're feeling and involves them in something else, and stay with them during the time in. And that's inconvenient and time consuming. But we saw one by one, our children learn to be able to take care of themselves. Mom, I'm distraught. Maybe they would say, or I'm about ready to implode. Is it okay with you if I just go read for a while? I say, yes, that's fantastic.
Or go outside, climb a tree. You know, boys need to go outside.
Yeah. Have a snack.
And when you're doing that, you can sometimes just give them a gentle correction. Yeah. Like, let's talk about what just happened. You know, you couldn't have slapped your sister. Here's how you could have handled that, you know. And if they respond, that's all you need to do. You know? So that's kind of one of the first tools of discipline that's in the Bible that we start off with our kids.
You know? And then basically you're also telling them, hey, I'm in this with you. Yeah. I'm not going to send you away to think about it. I'm in this with you and I'm training you. I'm helping you.
And that's what God does with us. He starts gently, like, you know, in marriage, we all know what that's like when we're starting to get in an argument and you hear that gentle voice, don't say it, just forgive. And when we listen, we're okay. And if we don't, you know, so anyway.
Yeah. So I love that first section. And I think something just to summarize it that you shared in the book, just the 10 year rule is what will this behavior attitude look like in 10 years? I love that. I think a lot of times people see three-year-olds get grumpy and they say, oh, I wasn't that cute and it won't be cute in 10 years. So I thought that was just such a great summary. You said children don't grow out of anything but their clothes. And I just thought that was brilliant. So let's transition now into ages 6 through 12, which you call the framing years. And you said, though, the goal and the vision of this season of parenting is to develop a heart of wisdom. Can you talk a little bit about the framing season of parenting?
Well, you know, I think these are really good years. Yeah. We really felt like this, they're less intense. And the kids in these years, especially if you've done some of the work before in the foundational years, they're very teachable and very relational. They still want all of mom and dad's time and attention. That's about to change.
Please don't tell me that.
Now they want to be with you all the time. And so taking advantage of that is really important because that's a good thing.
Yeah, if I could interject, in our kids' lives, by 6, 7, 8, they'd already given their life to the Lord, you know, in a young child's way. They'd received the Lord. That was the first step. You know, they all got baptized around there, 7, 8, 9 years old. 10. You know, Elizabeth was 10. And so we call this the framing years. But Diane came up with a tool called the box, which I think you should mention, even if it's briefly, because this is really effective during this framing year.
Yeah. So the box is basically what I came up with as a way for myself to put it all together for me in the moment. So otherwise, I felt like sometimes all I ever did was police my children. Like I was just a disciplinarian who read good Bible stories to them at night, you know. Mm. So the box is a way of understanding everything about the way God parents us, so that I don't just become a policeman to my kids, and so that I'm taking care of the whole child. And it's basically a frame that we build around our children's lives in order to give each of our kids a place of security in which they can grow and thrive into who God wants them to be. Not into a cookie cutter version of what you hope they will be, but who God really created them to be in. Starts off with Jesus is the foundation. He's the bottom of the box, we say. If you've ever moved, and I love books, so I move too many books. And if you don't have a good bottom of the box, those books will fall right through, right? So, you know, the foundation is Jesus. It's not the Christian way of living. It's not a Christian method or technique or a oneness or any good thing. It's not a political party. It's really just Jesus. And so we saturate our children in Jesus, who he is, what he wants for them, and what pleases him, that they are beloved by him. And so you have a disciplinary thing come up there. Your daughters are fighting over something inevitably that one has, therefore the other one wants it right now. And so the tendency is to come in immediately and just stomp them with discipline, right? You know, stop that right now. It's loud and But instead, if we bring Jesus first into the conversation, we talk to them about Jesus, Philippians 2, perhaps, you know, about caring about the needs of others. And we bring in discipline. In the book, we lay out 5 rules of discipline that we found, not the only way to discipline, but 5 good principles for discipline that we find in Scripture. So you go in your toolbox, you figure what is appropriate to that situation. Maybe it's the mildest one. Maybe it's a correction. And you just say, honey, don't do that. You can't grab your sister's doll from her. You ask nicely. Or you come to me and ask me. And that's the discipline aspect. You bring in Jesus to it. Maybe sometimes that's just singing a song to get them off of their anger track. You bring some order into their lives. That's another, the third side of the box is order. And that's the things every good parent does. The nap time, the healthy food, being outside a lot, checking that the pace of your life is congruent with the pace at which your children can go. Putting down the cell phone because your kids need so much eye-to-eye, unbroken attention. That's all order. And then the top of the box, which we couldn't find just one word to fit the top of the box, and really is Phil's always contribution to our family.
Affection, affirmation, and fun. Yeah.
Come on, I'm with you.
Yeah. Yes. When you do all 4 at once in response to a difficulty or a problem or a conflict, instead of seeing that resentment in your child or that, depending on the personality, or the sulking or the being too hard on themselves, you see your children just thrive because you're doing all 4 at once. You're disciplining, you're bringing in Jesus, you're bringing in lots of fun, affection, affirmation, and you're putting some order back in their lives to make it possible for them to obey. So the box was for me to stop feeling like a policeman and stop feeling crabby all the time and realize this is really does take everything.
Yeah. And it's not something that you just use age 6 to 12. You start young, but it's very effective in age 6 to 12. It really, really is. And the other things that we focused on were the same things that you read about Jesus when he was 12 years old, which would be the end of what we call the framing stages. Luke 2:52, it says Jesus grew in wisdom, in stature, and in favor with God and favor with man. And stature just means he was growing into a young man. And then he grew in wisdom, and that's really character if you do study on it. So we worked on things like integrity and hard work and those kinds of things. And he grew in favor with man. In other words, people loved to be around him because he loved people. And so we talk about loving people on purpose, and you teach that to your kid. And he grew in favor with God. He was intimate with his father. And so this is the perfect time. Your kids can read now. And so not only do you read the Bible to them, you guide them in how to read the Bible for themselves, and you make it a daily thing. Just they've seen you doing it for years and years and years. And now you say, now go do what you saw mom did do. And then you help them in that. And then they develop their own walk with God, and you guide them through it, you know? So just these framing years are just perfect for this. And if you do this, then in their teenage years, they will have their own, even though they're young, their own walk with God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's huge. And I would love to hear you talk about the teenage years, which is the next season. You call it the installing functional systems, age 13 through 17. Well, I would love to hear you just talk about the teenage years in general. I do want to hear you talk a little bit about, I don't want to say how strict you were, but the boundaries that you put around your kids. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, when I was interviewing John Mark, he talked about how you guys were very, very strict. But now, you know, with his kids, we were just talking about they don't have screens in their house and how, you know, strict he is with his kids. And he hopes that, you know, they'll come back and thank him one day. Can you just talk about the teenage years, boundaries, and anything parents need to know?
Yeah, I think parents are, for whatever reason, I think it's partly the fiery darts of the evil one and just the pull of the world. Like, you know, your kids want whatever. I mean, we were like radical. I mean, in our day, it was like video game. We never had any kind of video game in our house. Now, we allowed them, if they went to a friend's house, they could play it there, but we just didn't want it in the house. We didn't have, you know, back then it was VHS movies, right? So I started getting old Walt Disney. We had a blast together. We'd have Friday night taco nights and ice cream and movies, but we chose the movie. And so we, because I messed up in my college years, you know, in the area of immorality. And so when I started dating Diane, man, I wanted our relationship to be pure and I wanted our home to be centered on Jesus. And so we said yes to a lot of things. We said no to a lot of things. And we weren't pressured into doing anything that we knew wouldn't help them. So today it's like, you know, does your middle schooler need an iPhone with internet access? Of course not. They're going to get into trouble really fast. And so it's okay to say no, and you say it in a loving way and you explain why and you set the boundaries because you are the priest. You, mom and dad, are the spiritual covering over your kids under the Lord. And so you want to protect them when, you know, if you don't just let anything into your home, right? Like you're not going to some, you know, guy bangs on the door and he wants to kill everybody and come and steal everything. Oh, come on in, right? And yet we'll invite sometimes movies or things into our home. So there are movies we would watch and just turn it off. You know, this movie doesn't honor the Lord. Oh, yeah, come on. You know, so way we did it. We don't really think of ourselves.
At the time, I don't think that they thought we were being strict because
we were having so much fun.
We were having so much fun. Yeah. And we always tried to make our house like the place everybody wanted to come. So, you know, we filled up, of course, back then we didn't know healthy eating like we do now. So the kids have grown up to teach us a whole lot about that.
Yeah.
But we always had pizzas in the freezer and
from Costco
and things so that even in the teenage years, they were always having game nights at our house or playing
or movie
hide
nights.
And go seek in the dark. And, you know, in one of our houses that had a basement and
they destroyed our couch and destroyed the rug. Okay. It's worth it.
Yeah.
And basically we like if they wanted to spend the night at somebody's house and we didn't know them, we just said no.
Wow. But they can come spend the night at our house.
I was just going to ask that. Yeah, I know. Now, I had no boundaries growing up, so I wish I had you as parents. I mean, it was awesome when I was in middle school, but looking back, that did not help set me up for life. But so you would allow sleepovers at your house.
Yeah, but if I remember one guy that, you know, one of our sons had over and we just felt like he's not a good influence on our daughters who were becoming, you know, 13 and 14. And so even that case, we had to say no,
I just had an uneasy feeling.
Uneasy feeling when he was in the house. But we're not saying you can't ever go play music with him or whatever, but no. So
even for years when we had teenagers, we didn't want our teenagers on the road New Year's Eve. So for years we had a big sleepover. We had a two-story house. The boys slept downstairs, the girls slept upstairs.
Yeah.
And we asked them each to bring their favorite junk cereal for breakfast the next day. And, you know, it was New Year's Eve at the Comer house and it was so fun. So it's not like they felt like we were being strict. It was just, we didn't allow certain things. And by the time actually they were teenagers, we didn't have a lot of rules. We just had a lot of conversations. You know, what do you really think about that? Why do you think that would be good for you? Trying to teach discernment, can you foresee some of the temptations that might come up if we allow you to do that? But we just tried to involve, at that point, we tried to get them thinking a little more maturely than was natural.
Yeah, because
so we didn't have a lot of rules as older teenagers.
Because you have a relationship with them. So you can share, hey, the Bible says bad company corrupts good morals. Right. He who walked with wise men shall be wise. And so, you know, there were two guys in particular who were kind of nice guys, but they weren't walking with the Lord at all. They were musicians and we knew him from church. And when one of our daughters started really wanting to hang out with them, we had to shepherd that. I mean, you're shepherding your kids and it's a conversational, but it involves some, you can't be at their house at midnight, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just feel like you're doing it in partnership with the Lord and you're praying for your kids all the time. Mm-hmm. And he gives moms and dads a sense. Yeah. And we like to say, listen to your spouse. Because sometimes one of you just knows, like my wife's more of an intuitive and I've learned to listen to her. She just has a sense about something, you know, I don't want to just blow her off. I think, okay, well, then we need to watch that.
Yeah.
Doing your kids something good by putting because the whole idea of the box is as they grow and mature and show their own trustworthiness. You just keep expanding the box until one day there's no box.
Yes.
And they put a box around themselves, right?
Yeah.
And then when they mess up, you tighten it up, and that's where restrictions come in. Maybe, hey, you were supposed to be home at 11 o'clock. It's our car, not yours. And you came home at 2. Therefore, you can't use the car for the next 2 weeks. But I love you, son. And you know,
I'm
not mad at you. I'm not shaming you because I believe you're trustworthy. And so show me that you're trustworthy and you'll be able to use the car again. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. As we start to wrap up, just for time's sake, you end the book talking about the season 18 to 22, and you said it's completing the finished work. And there's two things I would love to hear you talk about. One is the list. You made a list of 10 things you've got to teach your kids, which I loved. But two, which I thought was very, very fascinating. It was a small section, but you wanted to teach them to have a theology of suffering. And I thought that was so interesting. And I would love to just hear you talk about that for a few moments.
Well, that was... comes out of my own story, and actually out of my own story of failure as a young woman, as a young mom, because I didn't have a theology of suffering. It was pretty much a pop theology, almost what I call a bumper sticker theology, that translated to, okay, if I follow all the rules, if I do everything I see that God says and that my spiritual directors tell me I should, then God will protect me from suffering. And of course, now I know that that was a very rose-tinted glasses kind of a view of God, that now I have a deeper understanding. But at the time, in my mid-20s, that's really the way I lived and believed. And inexplicably, when I was 26, I began to lose my hearing. It was years later that it was theorized that it came from an autoimmune disease. Now we know so much more about those, and that something triggered my body's immune response to attack the cochlear nerves in both of my ears simultaneously. And the cochlear nerve is behind the ear. My ears are formed perfectly, but it's a nerve that turns the mechanical sound that your ears hear into an electrical pulse to the brain, so that your brain can register the sound that your ears take in. And unbeknownst to me, those nerves were being attacked by an immune response from my body. And very quickly, in about 3 years, I lost most of my hearing, from about 26 to 30. I had young children and godly husband, a beautiful home and a beautiful life. And all of a sudden, I'm going deaf. And the doctors tried everything to stop it, and not knowing a cause and not understanding it, were unable to even slow it down. And in the middle of that, my theology, my weak theology of suffering, just pretty much collapsed, because I felt like I'd been doing all the things I was supposed to do, following all the rules, and God wasn't holding up his end by protecting me from inexplicable hard things and suffering. And I was terrified. I was just terrified, because at the time it just seemed like there was no hope. There was no end to this. And how was I going to raise my children to love and follow Jesus if they couldn't even talk to me? And, you know, when you're losing your hearing so, so fast, it's like your whole soul can't even keep up with it. You can't. It felt like every week I was every week losing some more. So in the middle of that, Phil, very cautiously, because I was pretty on edge. I was angry, to be honest with you, hiding a lot of anger.
And depressed.
And he suggested that I go to the elders of our church and ask them to pray for healing. So I said yes. And they did. And, you know, I write a little bit about the story in the book, but even more about the first book that I published, which is called He Speaks in the Silence, Learning Intimacy with God by Learning to Listen. And in that little cinder block room off the main auditorium in our little church in Santa Cruz, as the elders prayed for me, God just met me there in the most real and vivid way that I could even imagine. He met me there in my anger, in my poor theology of suffering, in my entitlement, and just showed himself to me and really healed the parts of me that actually needed healing more than my ears needed healing. and changed me. I mean, really changed me. And there was a time of surrender to the love of God, not to the authority of God. Authority was not a problem for me. I'm a rule follower. But surrendering to the love of God. Could I trust him even in this hard thing? Even if he didn't heal me, knowing he could. And basically from about that point on, unbeknownst to me, the hearing loss started to slow down to about 5% a year, which was helpful. But I was still wore the biggest hearing aids, they call them deaf aids, that you could wear. And I was still very obviously hearing impaired, had a very difficult time hearing ever in public, and had a really hard time hearing my children. But God had met me there in such a real and gracious and impossible way that all of a sudden he was turning it okay for me. He was turning something awful into something really beautiful. So the point now, so by 30, I was functionally deaf. By 40, I was completely deaf. And at that point, had a cochlear implant, which is a miraculous. In the meantime, in that 10 years, the cochlear implant had been perfected. And now I can actually be listening to you and hear what you have to say through it. But I'm actually completely deaf. I take the cochlear off and there is absolutely no actual sound that penetrates. I hear through a computer and it's not perfect, but it's amazing. It's wow. Totally amazing. But in the midst of all that, I began to see so many other people's stories who, like me, almost lost their faith in the face of unexplained and unexpected suffering. I mean, you expect maybe somebody my age now, 62, to begin to think, okay, they might begin to lose your hearing, but you don't expect a 26-year-old to lose their hearing completely. And we have seen so many stories of these kids are raised in these really solid, good Christian homes. They're leaders in their community and their youth group. They're honestly walking with God. And something deeply disappointing happens to them. Unexpected, out of the blue, shouldn't be that way. Something about our fallen world that invades their life. And so often those kids don't just drift away in indifference, but we see so many of them and their parents are perplexed, run away from God in anger and disbelief, unbelief even. You know, he must not be real. And when you dig a little bit, so many of their stories go back to a weak theology of suffering like I had. It made me aware that I wanted my kids to grow up with a totally biblical understanding of the part that suffering plays in our lives, the fact that Jesus said, we will suffer in this world, we will suffer. My theology doesn't actually lead me to believe after much study that God causes the suffering. So we taught our children that suffering entered our world at the fall in the garden, and entered our DNA at that time. And it is a fact of our lives. That's how we taught our kids. But that God uses that suffering to bring glory to himself and actually to bring beauty into our own lives.
Sure.
So that now I can say with absolute confidence, and I'm going to tell you, be honest, it probably took me at least 20 years to be able to say this, that I absolutely love being deaf. I have the best of both worlds. John Mark will tell you, in his love of quiet like I have and being an introvert, that he's jealous of me, that I can take this device off and my world goes totally silent. And I can disconnect in a way that is, I mean, it's funny, but it's actually, honestly, a beautiful, peaceful ability. You know, my grandkids call it my superpower.
She can hear or not hear.
I don't have to hear.
And if I talk too much, you know, she has to unplug to get rest. I love my talkative husband, but right now I need to unplug. But anyway, Jesus said, in this world you shall have tribulation, but take courage, I've overcome the world. John 16:33. So teach your kids that walking with Jesus, you know, why some people suffer deeply and others don't, it's just things we don't understand. But you want to raise your kids to know that following Jesus doesn't mean everything's going to go perfectly in my life, but he will be with you. in the good times and in the hard times, at the mountaintops and in the valleys. Mm-hmm. And it's in the valleys that really he refines us and molds us and makes us more like him. And so just, you know, bringing your kids up to know that, that sometimes God will use us. I mean, it says that when we suffer, he comforts us so that we can comfort others with the comfort that we've been comforted with by God. And so it's just part of his plan to show himself to the world.
Yeah. Well, Phil and Diane, this time together has been rich. Thank you both for saying yes to Jesus in your lives. Thank you for both raising passionate Jesus followers that have impacted my life and our generation. And thank you for this time. As we close our time together, is there anything else that you want to share with parents today before we wrap up?
Just one thing. If you are a follower of Jesus and you have children, your children are your legacy. The greatest thing you will ever do in life, the greatest accomplishment that you will ever accomplish, will be to raise your kids to follow the way of Jesus. It's not a secondary thing. It's not a side thing. It's the most important thing. When you get old and you look back, that's what you will really consider your success or failure, is what God did through your children. And so just remember that. That's why the Apostle John said in 3 John 4, I have no greater joy than this, to hear of my children walking in the truth. And I just want to say that.
Amen.
And now it is our greatest joy, and we'll be able to see the fruit.
Well, thank you both again. And again, parents, leaders, if you're listening to this, please go out and buy a copy of this book. If you email me, I might buy you a copy. So you need this. Thank you both for writing it, and hope you have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Hey, leader, thank you so much for listening to my conversation with the Comers. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. And you can find ways to connect with them and links to everything that we discussed in the show notes at l3leadership.org/284. And hey, as always, if this episode helped you, please share your key takeaways on social media or send this episode to two or three other leaders that you think it could add value to. Again, you could really transform someone's life with this content and add value to them, and you can help us grow our audience and reach more leaders. So thank you in advance for that. Well, leader, I tell you all the time, but I really believe that if you want to 10x your growth this year, then you need to either launch or join an L3 Leadership Mastermind Group. Mastermind groups have been the greatest source of growth in my life over the past 6 years. And if you're unfamiliar with what they are, they're simply groups of 6 to 12 leaders that meet together on a consistent basis for at least 1 year to help each other grow to their maximum potential, to achieve their goals, to do life together, and to hold each other accountable. So if you're interested in learning more about mastermind groups, go to l3leadership.org/masterminds. And as always, I like to end with a quote, and I'll actually quote the Apostle John. He said this, and this was in Phil and Diane's bio, and I just love this. He said, I have no greater joy than this, than to hear of my children walking in the truth. I just love that. And leaders, the most important place we'll ever lead is in our homes. I hope that you'll lead well. I hope that this episode helped equip you to lead a little bit better. Thanks so much for listening. Lauren, I love you so much. We pray for you. We believe in you. Don't quit. Keep leading. And until next time, keep making a difference.